Share screen. Test the share screen. Ask well. Did you, can you see the squiggles in the two corners?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So we were doing gravity waves. I'm not sure exactly where we got to. Haven't looked at the last time's notes. I get completely confused. I'm teaching two different courses, so by this time I don't know where I am in any of them. So did I go through the derivation that H equals zero? Or did I do proof by blatant assertion last time?
I think that was an assertion.
Okay. So we have we discover that if we do an appropriate coordinate transformation, we have that box Hij equals zero for the gravity waves. And that H, I guess I was using alpha and beta for the four-dimensional ones. If we apply those coordinate conditions, this leaves us with the coordinate condition that box psi alpha equals zero, where box is di eta ij, d alpha eta alpha beta d beta, where these are constants. They don't depend on the coordinates. That's, for example, plus one, minus one, minus one, minus one, the flat space time metric. Now we wanted to set H equals zero, but we have to maintain these conditions. If we do a coordinate transformation, now we know that box H is box of eta I alpha beta H alpha beta. These are all constants. The etas are all constants, so I can take them outside outside of this double derivative over here. And so that's eta alpha beta box H alpha beta, which is equal to zero. When we do a coordinate transformation, H goes to H plus D alpha zeta alpha plus, sorry, twice plus twice d alpha zeta alpha, just from the coordinate transformation that we know for H. So the question is, can we find a zeta in such a way that this guy is still box H is equal to zero, and such that this cancels out this. So we want minus twice d alpha equals h. Well, we can simply choose di are equal to zero. So we choose our new coordinate transformation so that di equals zero. And then here we get minus twice d zero. And zeta sub zero is the same as zeta superscript zero, because you raise and lower with eta, and eta zero, zero is just equal to one. So if we solve this equation, which is of course easy enough to do, that's minus the integral of h dt. And one can quickly check that if h obeys box equals zero, then box of zeta zero is equal to zero, as we require to maintain the coordinate condition that we had up here. So this guy maintains that coordinate condition and sets h equals to zero. So we can now assume that h is equal to zero. And we now have three conditions on the coordinate transformation. Namely, we want that box zeta alpha equals zero. And we want to keep h equals zero, so that's h equals d alpha zeta alpha, which is d naught zeta naught minus di zeta I. And I'm going to use this. This is not tensors or anything, but I'm going to use the summation convention so that even if we have two lower indices the same, that means sum over them. And here I goes from 1 to 3. And alpha goes from 0 to 3. So this is the sum over I equals 1 to 3 of di. So we're using the summation convention. This is not a tensor operation. It's a completely coordinate dependent operation, but that's okay. Okay. So now we want to set H0I equals zero. And we can do that. We know that H0I goes to H0I plus D0 plus DI zeta 0. Now, let's take the time derivative of both sides. And to simplify things, I'm going to use that D naught is the same as a superscript dot. So if I take the time derivative on both sides here, I get H dot 0i goes to H dot 0i. Sorry, let me not do it that way. So what we want need is that B zero zeta I plus D I theta zero is supposed to be equal to minus H zero I. If we manage to do that, then the new H0i will be equal to zero after we've done this infinitesimal coordinate transformation. So we have to try and solve this equation. The way we're going to do it is we're not going to take a time derivative on both sides. So I get d0 squared zeta I here plus di d zero zeta zero is equal to minus h dot zero I. I'm just writing the dot there to make it to mean I have to write fewer things. Just remember that dot is the same as the derivative with respect to x zero, which is t. Well, this guy, because I want to make sure that grad squared of zeta I is equal to zero, this guy is grad squared, where grad squared is di. D zero of zeta zero is di of zeta I from the gradient. We demand that zeta I has to be such that its gradient is equal to zero. So this becomes di dj zeta j equals minus h naught I. I can find the inverse, well, it's sort of the inverse of this expression, if I use dk di minus twice grad squared delta Ki. If I apply that to the expression on the other side, I get dk grad squared di zeta I. Remember that the derivative commutes, so I can, if I have the derivative on the outside here, that's the same as the derivative on the inside, because ordinary derivatives commute with each other. Covariant derivatives don't commute with each other, but these ordinary derivatives do commute with each other. Minus twice grad squared. DK DI zeta I plus DK grad squared DI zeta I minus twice grad squared zeta I. Equals. DK. DI. H. Zero I. Dot plus twice grad squared DI H H zero K. Dot. Now, this term and this term and this term all cancel. They're all the same as each other. Grad squared zeta is just the time derivative. So we get twice the time derivative to the fourth power of zeta I. So this is d zero of zeta I is equal to minus DK DI H zero I dot plus twice H zero K triple dot. And this I can solve very easily. Of this expression in here. So it's the third time, that's the fourth time integral. Now, an integral of a derivative is the original expression, unless the original expression was constant. Because obviously, if the original expression was constant, then h dot is equal to zero. So any part of this which is time independent doesn't get canceled out by this coordinate transformation. But you would hardly call something that doesn't change at all in time as being a gravitational wave. This is in fact fortunate because there are terms in H0i which are constants, things like the effect of the angular momentum of the central body, or things like the mass of the central body that would be in H0 would have the central mass of the central body, and the central mass doesn't change. So you don't want them to be able to be canceled out, or else you would be canceling out the Schwarzschild solution. And this tells you you can't cancel out the Schwarzschild solution because it's a constant. So it doesn't participate in this. You can't do a coordinate transformation which cancels it out. Otherwise, I could rewrite this as, for time dependent stuff, as 1/2 of the triple integral of dk times the divergence of 0i minus the first integral of minus the first integral of h 0 k. So this is d cubed t, and this is d t. To some extent, it's better keeping this expression. Because it explicitly shows you which terms in H0K or these divergence of H0I don't participate in the integrals. For H triple dot equals, sorry, H dot equals 0 type terms. So we've now managed to set H equals 0. We've maintained D alpha H alpha alpha 0 equals 0. And we've maintained H equals, this is H bar. But if H equals 0, then H bar is the same as H, because H bar is H minus 1/2 of the trace. But if this is true, this tells me that dt of H 0, 0 is equal to di H 0 I. And I've just done a coordinate transformation such that that's equal to 0. H 0 I is equal to 0. So the time derivative of H 0, 0 must be equal to 0. So the only thing that's not equal to 0 are places where H 0, 0 is a constant. So I get H 0, 0 equals H 0 I equals 0, unless H 0, 0 or H 0 I are constants. We can now solve the equation H alpha B I J, because H I J is what's going to be important, is equal to minus 8 pi times T I J. I and J are, again, still the spatial ones. These are this is the guys that are supposed to be important. And so we find that Hij is equal to minus 2 times the integral of Tij times T minus X prime. Minus T primed no T primed. Over X minus X prime T cubed X primed. And if we go far away, into the so-called radiation zone, then I can expand, I can assume that X is very large and only maintain terms to first order in X. So first order in X. And so Hij is minus two times the integral of Tij at T minus X primed. Over X minus X primed. X primed. So this is the retarded Hij at the point T and X, where X is much larger than any X primed in T, looks like this. Now, we can in fact go ahead and do a coordinate transfer, rewrite this thing via the trick. I can rewrite that as Hij equals the integral of minus 2 times di di dk x I plus, T K J plus D K X J times T I K This pen keeps shutting itself off. And these are all primes. DQ cubed x primed. That's delta ij, delta kj. So that's equal to minus two. We need to take 1/2 of this. Because both of these terms are Tij, and we only had one Tij before. So that this 1/2 cancels with that two. So that gives me 1/x times. And now I can do an integration by parts on xk, because I'm assuming that the t is non-zero only in a confined area. And when I do the integration by parts, I get the divergence of t, but we know that t alpha beta d alpha is equal to zero. That's the conservation of energy momentum. So that gives us that d zero t zero rho equals d rho is equal to d I t I rho. From this divergence equation. So here I throw that k onto the t, so I can rewrite that as t zero k. So this is equal to x I, x I. This a bit, make it easier to write. Zero. Zero J plus X J T I zero G cubed X primed, and these are all primes. Now I can play exactly the same game again. I put in there minus 1/x. Oh, and because I did an integration by parts, there's a minus sign that comes in here. So this is equal to plus 1 times the integral of dk xj xi t zero k plus dk xi t k zero, and there's an xj cloud frontier. Just as we did before. And I can now once again do an integration by parts. And finally find that Hij is minus twice. No, minus not twice. The integral of xi, xj, t 0, 0, and I forgot. When I do the integration by parts, the divergence with respect to k gave me a time derivative. So both of these have a time derivative over them. That's this relation. So this has a double time derivative, d cubed x. This is the energy density. And this says, take xi, xj times the energy density and integrate it. That's the quadrupole moment. So I find that Hij 1 over x is 1 over x times the quadrupole moment. Of the energy density, the second derivative of that. Now, generally, this trace of this is not equal to zero, and we wanted the trace of that to be equal to zero. And so we can go through the same coordinate transformations that we did before, and we find that finally the Hij times times quadrupole moment the trace free quadrupole moment, which is qtij, is qij minus 1/3 Q delta ij delta ij. That's by making this guy trace free, transverse traceless, and I find this is my final expression. So
sorry, what is just in the last expression, what is Q?
So Q was the xi, xj times the energy density integrated.
But the Q without the subscripts.
Pardon? Oh, Q without the x subscript is the sum over I of qii. Is the trace of Q, of the matrix Q. So this guy is clearly trace free. I get Q there, and I get 3 times Q minus 3 times Q divided by 3 here. And so this guy, this QT IJ is trace free, which is good because HIJ is supposed to be trace free. So the, where am I going? The gravitational radiation is produced by trace free quadrupole moment. Is produced by the trace free quadrupole moment of the energy density. Thorne has argued that one can extend this to radiation, including gravitational energy effects. One can take G mu nu is minus 8 pi T mu nu. Now this guy is, looks like derivatives of G mu nu minus eta mu nu plus gamma type terms. Take these guys over onto the right hand side. Take any derivative of h times h or whatever over onto the right-hand side as well, and call those the gravitational energy. So on left-hand side, we have the linear equations for G mu nu minus eta mu nu. And on right-hand side, we have energy momentum of matter plus gravity. The stuff we stick on the right-hand side is certainly not a tensor. It changes depending on how one changes the coordinate system. But I can now go through all of the arguments that we had before and obtain, so all of this stuff, I could call T mu nu. And what I'm going to find is that now Hij is created by Qij of, oops, I don't want F. Of the this sometimes called the pseudo energy momentum tensor. It's pseudo because it's not a tensor at all. It is strongly coordinate dependent. But if one is looking at the small fluctuations in the gravity in the metric caused by this amount of energy, including the gravitational energy, the gravitational potential energy, then one can regard that right hand side as though it were a stress energy tensor for that small gravitational field that finally gets liberated as the gravitational waves. So although at first it looks as though the derivation is, you know, purely a derivation where everything is small, his argument is that that's actually not true, that if you include these extra sources of energy, that in fact, this is an exact solution for the equations. Of course, the problem is that the metric H and so forth enters into the pseudo-energy momentum tensor, and you have to solve Einstein's equations in order to know what it actually is. So although this is all very well and good as a theoretical construct, as a practical matter, it doesn't help very much because you don't know what the stress, what the gravitational terms that come in here without already having solved Einstein's equations. But this suggests that the quadrupole moment formula, which was derived by Einstein in 1918, is in fact good as a generic formula, conceptually at least, for general relativity. So the quadrupole formula is good even for the gravitational energy. That's the quadrupole moment of the gravitational energy that also comes into the expression. There are various things about it that's a little bit worrisome, because part of the problem is that we assume that the energy momentum, the Tij, not the script Tij, but the Tij was confined to a finite region of space. But the gravitational field obviously leaks out. It has these 1 over r kinds of terms, including the gravitational, the gravitational radiation itself has 1 over r terms, and those die off very slowly. If I square it, I get 1 over r squared, but even 1 over r squared extends all the way out to infinity. And that makes the derivation worrisome. Okay. So that gives us our sources. Of gravitational waves. As this quadrupole moment of the energy. It's not a coordinate invariant derivation. It's not a tensor equation. And so, you know, there are some worries about this. And it's impossible to solve without solving all of Einstein's equations anyway. But that suggests, for example, that if you have two dumbbells rotating around each other, whether they're rotating around each other because there's a piece of steel holding these two things together, or like this pen, as it rotates, it's the tension in the steel that holds the ends together and causes them not to fly off just as free particles. Or whether it's gravitational, these obviously have changing quadrupole moments in the x direction. Just at this moment, Q of XX is twice the mass times the distance divided by 2 squared, whereas Q of YY is much smaller than Q of XX if these masses are very small. And as they rotate, then Q of YY at T2, Q of YY is twice M D over 2 squared. And Q of XX is roughly equal to 0. So these guys are obviously changing as time goes by. And that change is going to emit gravitational radiation. That gravitational radiation carries away energy. And so the first test, by the way, this argument is given in Misner Thorne and Wheeler, which is 'Gravitation', which is one of the key textbooks in general relativity. It's a telephone book. It's over 1,000 pages long. And it looks very much like a telephone book. You know, it's about over a foot high. And, you know, it's bigger than an 8.5x11 sheet of paper with over 1,000 pages in it. Anyway, hidden in there is Thorne's argument for this. So this would apply whether these are orbiting each other because of gravity or are orbiting each other because of being a dumbbell. This was contentious basically ever since Einstein's 1916 and then 1918 papers on gravitational radiation. People worried about this. Eddington had some arguments that it should apply to planets as well. Various people throughout history have argued that it shouldn't apply to things gravitationally orbiting each other. And that was really only settled in the night, you know, Thorne's argument really only came out in the late 1970s when that big book got published. Almost everybody didn't believe those counter arguments. And by this time, that dispute has disappeared. So it's a 40-year-old dispute, which has disappeared. What do I want to do next? Oh, yeah. So one of the very first tests was when Hulse and Taylor found the binary pulsar in the late 1970s. To early 1980s. Try and find this. So what this was two neutron stars orbiting each other. Masses were within 1% equal. The orbit was actually an elliptical orbit, but let's not worry about that. And one of them was a pulsar. And here we are on Earth looking at the system. The orbit was neither edge on nor face on to us. It was about 50 degrees. Away from being face on to us. And this was a rapidly rotating pulsar, less than 1 second per pulse. Hulse and Taylor. Hulse was the graduate student. Taylor was the professor at Princeton. Were surveying, looking for neutron stars. Neutron stars had been discovered in the early 1970s. People started looking for them and started finding them. And they found one, and they discovered, lo and behold, that this pulsar seemed to be glitching. So if one looked at the period as a function of time, they found this. They came back 24 hours later, measured again, and found this. Came back again 24 hours later. I mean, they could only see this certain times of the night, found this. And eventually, after they looked at enough nights, they suddenly found it doing this and realized that what was happening was that this thing was actually doing this. I've got to squeeze this in. That there were three of these up and down sinusoidal motions every day. The period of this turned out to be 7 hours and 40 minutes. So it was almost exactly three of them per day. So these two pulsars were orbiting each other. And because of the Doppler shift of that orbit, were radiating, and you know, you would see those pulses Doppler shifted, and that would mean that the period that you see, this is the pulsar period, the pulsar period would seem to slow down and speed up as it traveled away from the Earth or traveled towards the Earth. Over a period of about 10 years, so this pulsar was extremely accurate, so it represented an extremely accurate clock. After about a year, they discovered that this ellipse, this had an elliptical orbit. The ellipse was advancing about 4 degrees per year. Now, the first thing was that this orbital period was 7 hours. Their mass was a little bit bigger than the mass of the sun. And as a result, these two guys are orbiting extremely close to each other. So the orbit, if this is a solar radius, the elliptical orbit of these two guys with respect to each other looked about like this, and the other one. So this distance is about one solar radius. So these are a lot close, and the mass is similar to the mass of the sun. They're a lot closer to each other than Mercury is. So instead of 4 seconds of arc per century, which is what you get for Mercury, this was about 4 degrees per day of the advance of the perihelion. So that was one of the first general relativistic tests that one could do on this system. Over the course of 10 years, because the pulsars are so accurate, you can also measure the period. The orbital period extremely exactly. And over the course of about 10 years, Let me stop share of this one and start share of this graph. Where's the graph? There we go. This is the plot of the change in the orbital period as a function of the year. And what they found was that the orbital period decreased. Well, we know in the solar system, the closer you orbit to the sun, the faster you go around the sun and the shorter the orbital period is. Mercury's period is about 80 days. Earth's is 1 year. Jupiter's is about 5 years, etc. Here the orbital period is 7 hours. And over the course of, well, in this case, it's 30 years. The period has shifted by about 40 seconds. So instead of being 7 hours, it's about 7 hours minus 40 seconds would be the period after 3 years. They first realized something was going on at about, after about 10 years. Oops. Oh, you're not seeing this. Are you seeing this graph?
Yeah.
Okay. Why is my... thing not, I don't have my annotation. Let's try that. Ah. So by about 19, so they first discovered this in 1973. By about 1980, they were starting to see the slowdown of the period. And they made their first prediction. They tested this. They knew very accurately what the masses of these two bodies were by that time, just from the Kepler orbital parameters and from the perihelion advance and transverse Doppler shift, etc. They also got estimates of the absolute mass of the system from the general relativistic effects. So they could predict how rapidly this thing should lose energy emitting gravitational radiation. And the two curves fell right on top of one another. The blue curve is the theoretical curve, and the dots are the actual measurements of the thing. So this has gone on for, this graph has gone on for 30 years, and general relativity still predicts the slowdown, the speed up of the orbit due to loss of energy due to the admission of gravitational waves extremely exactly to better than about 0.1% by now. This got them the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Committee sort of learned its lesson. They gave a Nobel Prize for pulsars. The pulsars were actually discovered by a graduate student. They gave the Nobel Prize to the faculty member, not to the graduate student. I mean, she was working, you know, she was on her thesis, she was working and the thesis advisor and she and a couple of other people decided that this was a rapidly rotating neutron star and so forth. So giving it to him was not a problem, but not giving it to her was larger, widely seen as a real problem. She was always very fair about it. Well, when they gave the prize for gravitational radiation, they gave it both to the graduate student and to the professor. Both the Hulse and Taylor. So they'd sort of learned their lesson. In around 2000, there was a new pulsar discovered. This one I call a binary pulsar. Let me go out of this and go back to my... whiteboard. So here, the orbit turned out to be almost exactly circular of these two guys around each other. So one is here, and they just orbit almost the same orbit. Their masses are the same to within 15%. By about 15%. One of them is about 1.1, and the other one's about 1.3 solar masses. So they're both orbiting almost exactly the same orbit, the same orbital plane. The orbit turns out to be almost exactly circular, which is to be expected, because if you have an elliptical orbit, the quadrupole moment is changing much faster in this part of the orbit than it is here. So more gravitational radiation is being emitted here than is being emitted here. And this tends to circularize the orbit very rapidly. So this is obviously an older pulsar system. The two orbits have become almost exactly circular orbits around each other. The other difference between, there are two other differences between this system and the Hulse-Taylor system. One is that both of these guys, when they discovered it, were pulsars. Both the A pulsar, as they call it, and the B one are both pulsars. So you can look, see the Doppler shift and the various relativistic shifts, not just with one of them, but with both of them. And so you can very, very rapidly discover what the various Newtonian parameters are, because you know exactly what the velocity of both of these objects is. The second thing was that these lie exactly to within less than 1 degree of the plane of the observer, us. So the plane of the system is exactly edge on to within 1 degree, which means that this pulsar almost gets eclipsed by this pulsar. That's part of what allowed one to see that Shapiro time delay graph that I showed you when we were talking about the Shapiro time delay. The light from this pulsar, if we look at this system edge on, here's one of the guys, here's the other guy, is almost directly behind. And so the impact parameter here is very small. And so you get a very large Shapiro time delay. Easily measure Shapiro time delay. Also, these again have about one solar mass. They're orbiting each other even faster than in this case. Their velocity is about 3 times higher. Their frequency is about, their frequency is about 3 times higher as well. The orbital period is about 3 times higher as well, because the energy radiated turns out to go as the quadrupole, the third derivative of the quadrupole moment. That means that they radiate about 10 times as much energy. This one radiates much more energy than this one does. And so within less than 3 years, one was able to get graphs that are as good as the Hulse-Taylor graphs that we have now, only over 3 years rather than 30 years. So within about the first 3 months, one got comparable results to what Hulse and Taylor got the Nobel Prize for. It was, I keep thinking that some relativist must have been praying very hard in order to get a system that's so ideally adapted to doing general relativistic tests. Except for the problem was that I can't believe that any relativist would have had the chutzpah to pray for something that's this good. God was extremely generous to us in this case, because the system, it's only, I think, about the third, there are only about three binary pulsars known. And this one is just so, so good for testing general relativity that one just can't believe it. So in a sense, these two were the first detection of the effect of gravitational wave. So first detection of the effect of gravitational waves. As I mentioned to you last time, since the 1950s, Weber tried to detect gravity waves or gravitational waves on Earth by having this one-ton mass of aluminum and looking for the vibrations left behind in the aluminum as the gravitational wave went through. He thought he'd seen something, almost certainly didn't. By the 1980s, they began to develop LIGO. This is a 4 kilometer long interferometer. You shine light in, that measures the change in distance of these two mirrors, the differential change in distance. So if this mirror moves in and this mirror moves out, that changes the interference pattern here. And they can, using a strong enough laser, they can measure that interference pattern to about one part in 10 to the 15th. You can measure the shift to about one part in 10 to the 15th of one fringe, which is pretty amazing. They began operation in the late 1990s. So this is 4 kilometers, 1990s. They began operations, saw nothing. They had regular observing sessions for about 5 years, saw nothing except noise, improved the detector. And then began to run the improved detector in 1915. 1915, 2015. And they were in their Shaketown run What this means is it's not an observing run. It means that you're willing to shut the whole thing down if you discover that there's something wrong to fix it. Observing runs, you just run come hell or high water. I mean, unless the thing just totally collapses, an earthquake hits and destroys the detector or something like that. But here you can shut it down, tweak something, run it, start it up again. And in the middle of their shakedown run, they suddenly saw a gravitational wave signal. So this was about 1 week in September into the run. They saw their signal. They took about a year to check everything to make sure that this wasn't some accident, that this wasn't some noise source, that Al-Qaeda hadn't decided to fool them by taking truck bombs and exploding them just beside each of the detectors at exactly the same time to make them mimic a gravitational wave signal. Of course, they might have noticed some other things going on if that were the case, or that some disgruntled postdoc hadn't gone ahead and gotten into the system and fooled them all by putting in this fake signal. And then in 1916, a year after Einstein's paper on gravitational wave signals, they published this with the first detection of gravitational waves on Earth. The origin of these waves was almost certainly two massive black holes orbiting each other, each of the order of 30 solar masses. So two black holes of 30 solar mass orbiting each other about 100 times per second. So this means that they're really close to each other. They're within a few Schwarzschild radii of each other as they're orbiting each other. And in fact, they saw that frequency of the gravity wave signal due to this orbital frequency increase from about 30 hertz to from about 60 hertz, because the signal, if you have two objects orbiting each other, the quadrupole repeats itself twice in one orbital period. So the signal is at about 60 hertz. That increased to about 300 hertz by the time these two black holes merged with each other and formed one big black hole of mass about 60 solar masses. So 230 solar mass merged into 160 solar mass black hole. In the process, emitting about 5 solar mass in gravitational wave energy. Over a time period of about 1/30th of a second. So that's greater than the energy in light from all the stars in the observable universe during that time. So it was an absolutely incredible amount of energy liberated. The magnitude of the gravity wave at Earth was about 10 to the minus 22. So the effect of this gravity wave on the Earth, on this LIGO interferometer, was to change the lengths of those two 4 kilometer arms by about one part in 10 to the 22. So that's about, a billion billionth of a nanometer. Sorry, about a billionth of a nanometer. Much less than the radius of a nucleus. Given that amount of energy, that's not a very large effect. So they also got the Nobel Prize. About 4 years ago for this result. So gravitational radiation exists. And the other thing that you learned about that is that black holes exist. Before, all you could do is to see black holes, is to see their effect on surrounding, on stars that are orbiting around it. But, you could always imagine that there's some weird something or other sitting there in the middle, which happens to be dark because it's not emitting any light, but has a sufficient mass to let these stars orbit around it. The stars are much, much farther away than the Schwarzschild radius. So one could imagine there's this big cold lump. You'd have to have very, very exotic physics in order to do that, but it's still a possibility. There's no way that anything except black holes could have produced exactly the kind of gravitational radiation that was given off by this system. So in 100 years from being a highly esoteric theory with about three tests to its credit, and all of the tests that anybody could imagine being impossible to measure, it has suddenly become, general relativity has suddenly really become a field at the heart of physics. Some of the most exciting things happening in physics nowadays are happening in the field of gravity and general relativity. Okay, so next time, I'll give my public lecture. This will be for you as the public on gravitational radiation. Its advantage is that it's highly non-mathematical, but it might help you to sort of have a grounding for all of the stuff that we've been talking about here. And then after that, non-linear gravitational waves. It turns out that one can actually solve Einstein's equations exactly for plane gravitational waves, plane-fronted gravitational waves. And so that's what I'll do in the following lecture. Okay. Save this. And stop share. And stop recording. Oops.